You would like to begin by telling me something about your background, where you grew up, and how that influenced your decision to become an anthropologist.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's a can be a very long story. But I suppose I should say first that I was a child of two academics, a couple of academics anyway. My father was the dean of a medical school at Washington University in St. Louis. And he was a biochemist who became a pediatrician and then a dean. And he was a researcher, very scientific chap. And he was also an outdoorsman. He took me hiking, canoeing, and swimming, and things like that. He was himself a horseback rider and had been the first doctor in Yellowstone Park when it was still an army post before it was a national park. He was, but I lost him when I was 12 years old. He died of some botched surgery. And then I had my mother's family who were also in academia. My mother's father was the dean of architecture at Washington U, and also an actor and a poet and a Latin scholar, and did a lot of travel in Europe in order to get ideas for his architecture. So I had the arts on one side and the sciences on the other. And they were, in a sense, displaced persons in St. Louis because they were both from the East Coast. My mother was from New York area, and my father from Baltimore. And in moving to St. Louis, which they did fairly early in the century, 1910 or something like that, they thought of it as going to the frontier. Exploring new territory. They were sort of bringing culture to the Midwest, which did not have many paved roads even at the time. But they were starting a new couple of institutions there. So that was their situation. And of course I met a lot of doctors and artists and all kinds of people in St. Louis. So it was a rather rich start in life, you might say. But my father was appointed to the University of California when I was 12 years old and became the dean of the medical school at San Francisco. So again, I had a good deal of academic exposure. We set up a house in Berkeley, but then he shortly died. That kind of interrupted my education, but I got back to St. Louis with my mother a year later, having missed most of the sciences that I should have had in beginning high school. But the school was of a very liberal persuasion, and they said, well, you can do the arts if you want to do that. And I had done arts. I'd done lots of French and some Latin and painting and music and history, and so that was fine as far as the school was concerned, and I didn't have to do a lot of chemistry, which I had none of actually, or even very much math, which I regretted, but I couldn't. I hadn't got on the escalator at the right time, and therefore I had to defer that. But I enjoyed doing literary things, and I ran a school magazine, a couple of school magazines for a couple of years there, and enjoyed that, and wrote a lot. I liked to write, and I got myself a national scholarship to Harvard, and went off there. I arrived there just in the very quarter, the very semester was there, when Pearl Harbor was struck by the Japanese. I was 17, I'd gone to college a bit early, and so I wasn't drafted immediately. All the 18-year-olds were drafted at that point, which left the freshman class, the sophomore class at Harvard rather small. But I should backtrack a little and say that I had taken up my father's lead and done a little horseback riding in the Rockies, summer camp, and then had taken up youth hosteling. I was eager to go to Europe, but with Hitler there, couldn't do that. So I settled for bicycle riding in the United States. And I loved the country. I loved being in rural areas. And it was possible then to bicycle around in a large part of the country without worrying about too many automobiles. There were no super highways then, and everything was rather slow. And so I used all my vacation times for touring. I ultimately went through 14 states and several parts of Canada on a bicycle with a friend in my teens, and sleeping in mostly farms where the youth hostels were. And I liked that a whole lot. And I'd done some drawing, and so I took along a pencil and paper and drew a lot of landscapes and some people and things like that. It generally oriented me to rural living. So I continued that as far as possible in college, but I had intended to go into anthropology, actually, before I went there. In fact, I chose Harvard because there was some undergraduate anthropology there in the person of Clyde Cluckham. Have you met him or heard
him? Of course.
Well, he was actually in Washington, D.C. I think probably some military outfit had called him to Washington. He was being consulted after Pearl Harbor by people who wanted to know about how you deal with other nations, cultures, and psychologies, and so on. So I didn't see him, but they said, well, you can do some other major, it doesn't matter too much in your freshman year, you've got to do all sorts of things anyway. History, world history, and language. And the college said, you've got to do something useful in the war, so study German, or so I'll study German. And so I did that for a year. Clyde wasn't there, but I took up as a major art history, which was congenial as far as I was concerned. I wanted to do that sort of thing anyhow, but it wasn't what I intended to major. So I did that for a while, and they said, well, you can, I didn't know whether Clyde was coming back or not, so you can go into the artillery. Of course, you'll need a little more math for that, or you can do you're an art student, all right, you can paint camouflage on tanks or airplanes or something. Well, that didn't appeal to me too much. Then they said, in my second year, you've done German. Yeah, I liked the languages, that was fine. I did a little, but we have a program in Japanese, so you can study Japanese, and there's a great need for Japanese translators. I actually wanted my intention for other parts of the world that I wanted to go to beside Europe was China. I'd done a lot of time at the St. Louis Art Museum, which had a pretty good collection of ancient bronzes, which absolutely astonished me. And also the calligraphy interested me greatly. So I really thought I would like to be a sinologist and an anthropological sinologist, I guess. I was domiciled in Harvard Yard, right next to the Chinese library collection, and that was very intriguing to me. But the thought of them getting being useful in Japanese was very attractive. So I took that up and crammed Japanese. They had a super intensive course taught by an old white Russian named Sergei Eliseev, who was a wonderful character. He lived years in Japan. I guess he, you know, he left Soviet. When the Soviet became Soviet, he left. And had was sitting in Japan. But in any case, I found Japanese quite easy too, and was happy with another language. And they said, then if you go into, then Clyde came back the second year. So then I had practically all my courses with him. I studied, I think I had five different courses, and he was my tutor also. So I just saw him practically every day for about a year, which was great. You know, I really got an inside view, got all his personal opinions of things as well as the courses that he taught. So with all that, I then volunteered for early induction into the military. They didn't really want me. More people that they were swamped with, 18-year-olds. But they said, well, I thought, you know, they'll send me to Washington and I'll do some more Japanese. For everybody know, they sent me the infantry. So I had infantry training and became an infantry instructor for a while. And after, it was about a year later, I got finally back to Japanese, got reclassified, and then spent some time at Stanford doing more Japanese, and then some more in Washington, D.C., and after another year of that, and by then, they said, well, we need volunteers to go to Kunming to help Chiang Kai-shek defend China against Japanese. Well, I've been rather interested in China. In fact, politically, sentimentally caught up in the Sino-Japanese hostilities, and so I thought that would be great. You know, I could help oppose the Japanese takeover of China, and feeling young and foolish at age 20, I stepped forward. And they asked for volunteers, and I then was sent to India by way of a troop ship, which tried to get away from the Japanese naval sphere by going somewhere around the Arctic Ocean, south of Australia, and around to the back door of China, which was India. So at age 21, I stepped ashore in Bombay and was then thinking, well, they'll send me through India to Assam and then over the hump into China. And spent a week on a milk train, all carrying a rifle and doing all sorts of things to secure our life. I spent a couple of months in Indian Army camps and trying to drive a British Land Rover, which was entirely new to me. But I was posting the guard, I was doing all sorts of military things. I don't think I was well cut out for that life, but I didn't mind living in a tent or anything. So, but then they said, well, we're not going to send you over to Kunming after all. We got to Calcutta because Chiang Kai-shek is retreating up the Yangtze, and we don't want to send any more people there. It'd be better, we can receive Japanese radio messages in Almora, in the Himalayas, and so you can just work from there. So they sent me instead to New Delhi, I sat there and worked there in a post office building. It was a little postal station in the middle of Connaught Circus in New Delhi. And it was a secret thing. They brought us in there at night, and I was worked on the swing shift, which I did because I wanted to use the daylight hours as much as possible when I could be awake to see something of India. But that was all British Empire then, of course. And Churchill didn't want Americans in India. But, of course, he had to have them because the Americans had the airplanes and the other material and so on. So there were Americans there, all kinds of guys, as most of them operating secretly from each other. We had very little idea of what was going on there, except that we were in our little post office. I had to hide away translating Japanese radio messages, which were written down in pencil by sleepy Indian radio operators in Almora with lots of mistakes. So it was pretty much garbled stuff. And we had to translate those into Chinese telegraphic code using code book and correct all the mistakes they'd made, which wasn't easy because you didn't know it was a mistake until you translated it, and you had to translate it before you could tell what the mistakes were. So it was pretty difficult and messy work. But anyway, that's what I did for 8 hours of a shift for 6 months. Until the Japanese surrendered. And that happened while I was there in India. So we had a little victory parade. At that point I had no rifle, but we could just jump shoulder our pencils or something. But Churchill hadn't wanted the Americans there, so the consequence was that we weren't supposed to fraternize with Indians. Well, of course, it was impossible to be there and not deal with Indians. We had Indian servants. In the dorms where we lived, and of course they were around us all over everywhere else. But we weren't supposed to learn any Indian language. So all we had were little books that say, what time is it, and where's the bathroom, that sort of thing. But I think one or two of my fellow soldiers used the bearers, their servants in the dorms, to study Hindi, but I didn't. I just spent my time usually going around looking at things visually, sketching people and places around Delhi, which was interesting. It was, of course, loaded with history of all kinds. We had very few books. There was nothing. I think I read 3 or 4 books on Hindi. It's about all I had by way of preparation. So I was relying very largely on my eyes. But I was fascinated by villages that I could see. I could travel around on a bike nearby and see these mud walls and villages behind the walls. And I was very curious about what's going on there as an anthropologist. Anthropology, a would-be anthropologist, I had to learn a lot more. Of course, I knew that I couldn't at the time, but I resolved that I would try to come back and do that. So that's what happened. And then, as the Japanese surrendered, I was shipped back right away to Washington by air this time, and told I needed now to study Chinese. Well, I suppose I'd learned 5,000 characters, but of course they were not the same in Chinese. But it was. I didn't mind learning another language, so I went to work in Washington, D.C., in the Signal Corps. This was all Signal Corps operations. Studied Chinese. But my instructor, who was on leave, a professor from Harvard, he was in service himself, but he got out of uniform. And in fact, I got out of uniform rather early because of my 6 months overseas service, and most of the people who've been sitting in Washington all the time didn't get out so soon. But I then had the choice: would I go to the occupation in Japan? Would I work for them, or would I re-enlist, or what would I do? And I had a couple of months to think about it. Watched a lot of Japanese movies and discovered that there were at least 200 American naval officers who knew a lot more Japanese than I did because they'd had a conversational practice with prisoners and so on. So I decided I was way behind in Japanese language business, and I would need several more years of training. I came to Chicago at that point because I had what, 2.5 years of Harvard. They had a long list of requirements that I had to fulfill to get a BA. At the same time, Hutchins here at Chicago was offering, I guess, cut-rate degrees for Army veterans. They said, well, you've got all this Japanese now, so you've got the equivalent of a BA in Japanese. And all you do is to take a few comprehensive exams over other matters, language and sociology and history and a few things like that. And I did those, and that was okay. And so they said, well, you have the equivalent of a BA now, so you go right in for your master's degree. I chose that. I had chosen anthropology. I should go back a bit there and say that I got into that because, partly because my sister, much older than I, 9 years older, had married, had come to the University of Chicago and as an undergraduate in the college, and had married a graduate student in anthropology, a social anthropologist here, and he was very enthusiastic.
So you jumped ship from Harvard. You actually completed your BA here, and then went directly into.
Well, I took the equivalent. Yeah, right.
And went directly into. But let me ask you a question that intrigued me about Clive Cluckhone, since in the Peabody, you just see his name painted on one of the doors.
Uh-huh.
I think David Mabry Lewis occupied his office later on.
Cluckhone's name is still there.
Yeah. What was Clive Cluckhone like?
Well, I found him just very friendly and engaging and a passionate sort of person, in the sense that he sort of struggled over the ideas and said it's very important. And, you know, he had a sense of excitement about it. And he would sort of look off into space, and he seemed imaginative in that way also. He seemed to be quite orderly, and he assigned interesting books for me to read, and he was happy. I met him as a tutor about every second week, and he would usually give me 2 or 3 books to read before the next session, and I'm supposed to write papers about them and come read them to him. So he was very demanding, but he was also very receptive to my papers, and he was pleased and encouraging. So,
was this the period when social relations was?
No, it wasn't. But he advised me. He became my advisor then in my second year, and he said, "Well, you ought to study with Talcott Parsons, and you ought to study also get some depth psychology." And so I studied with, what's his name, T.A.T. Mann, and with White, who was a psychoanalyst. And so I did a bit of psychology. I hated the ordinary psychology, but I liked the deep stuff. So I had a course with, or 2 courses, I guess, with Parsons. It was on America, on the American family, or American occupational system, something like that. And a good sampling, any of the roots of Sacrail.
Now, when you started your graduate program in Chicago, did you have the idea that you were going to return to India to do field work?
Well, that happened after I got here. I think I brought my story up to my deciding to come to Chicago rather than to go back to Harvard at that point. And when I got here, people said, well, now Fred Egan had been here. He was the head of the Japanese training program that they had here. So he said, well, you could do Japanese. But on the other hand, here you've been in India. Nobody has been in India before you. There was one person, I think, David Mandelbaum, who was an anthropologist who'd worked. I think he'd gone in on the coattails of Murray Emino, who was a linguist. The British Empire did not want social scientists, and social sounded dangerous, and science sounded even worse, I guess. So they didn't really, you know, encourage this, but here, during the war, when I came back from India, I was in Washington for another 6 months, and I met Jeffrey Gorer there, who had been around all places all around the world. He'd been in Bali and Africa, and he'd gone to was Sikkim, and he said he wanted. I met him in Washington to socially dance, I think, or something. And he said, "What do you want to do in India?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to study peasants." And he said, "You can't do that. They lie to you all the time. They won't tell you the truth, you know." And I said, "Well, what is your experience?" And he said, "Well, I wanted originally to work in Bihar." And that was, of course, a very troubled area, and they had a lot of resistance to the empire there. And he was British, so he came in. The officials there were reluctant to let him in, even. But the villagers apparently were really hostile to him because they saw him as some kind of an official who was inquiring into their affairs. So he said, "You can't do that." But, you know, I said, "Well, maybe we have other ways of operating. It won't be so bad." Yeah, what you were asking?
Yeah, about your decision to return to India.
Yeah, that's right. So nobody had been there. There was nobody in this university. There was one retired missionary who was teaching in the Divinity School. And he had actually spent some years in India. Nobody else. Nobody on the faculty. I could study. They had no Indian languages taught except Sanskrit and Pali. And they were taught by the Russian literature person who had learned Sanskrit and Pali in St. Petersburg at the Language Academy. He was a white Russian prince, actually, had a lot of linguistic background, but it was remote, and he knew a little Indian history, and he read a bit. And he was a very, very good literature scholar, a nice guy, Jordy Babinskoy, but he didn't have any mind Indian, really. So I did what I could, but there was nobody here. On the other hand, Fred Egan said, "Well, look, we've got a very good library, start of a very good library here, because William Rainey Harper, the founder of the university, had wanted to do all of the Asian languages, and as much as he could, certainly the classical ones. So he had originally had a professor of Sanskrit here, and I think they'd had a couple of others, but they have none for the last 20 years or so, before I arrived. So, but they had a library. They bought a library. They bought up a whole Berlin bookstore, which was full of books about India, a large part of it, Sanskrit. But they also had lots of the Indian census and missionary monographs and British official memoirs and things like that. So Fred said, "Well, we really need somebody to work on India, and this is a wonderful opportunity. And it's just starting up now, and you can be in at the beginning of this venture of it." And I was studying, of course, Lloyd Warner also, and community studies were the thing to do, and I wanted to study a village, perfect fit. So Fred said, "We just read everything in this library, and you'd be ready to go." So I did.
You must have presented some challenge that there was no faculty advisor who was familiar with the region.
No, so I had to look for others, and I found a few Indian students around. There was no general importation of Indians, but there were one or two. There were really one or two. Other people hanging around, you know, whoever they were, the wife of somebody, and so on. And I found another graduate student there named Philip Talbot, who was a fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs, which was training people for the State Department. It was totally non-official, but it was a private foundation that thought it was that Americans needed to know a lot more about the rest of the world than they did. So they were training people, giving them long periods of 5-year appointments or something like that to learn all about this or that part of the world. And one of these persons was a man who later was in the State Department, but he was an officer in India, a naval officer in India, Phil Talbot. He was here, and he'd already spent 3 or 4 years in India, and he had lots of interesting connections. He met all kinds of people and lived for long times and in different parts of India. So he was a great source for me, and putting me in touch with people. So he knew about the best missionaries, the ones who'd been there a long time and were sort of social science oriented. So I wrote to William Weiser, his wife, who'd written a book called Behind Mud Walls, which is a very useful introduction. And I just began then collecting people all over. So I had a huge index, finally, of people to write. And so I wrote letters to everybody. You know, dozens and dozens of letters asking for their advice. Where to work, what would be interesting, what did they know, how does one do it, and so on. We had a lot of help from all these people.
Okay. And you went to do your first field work in the early 50s in Uttar Pradesh.
Yeah, that's right.
And what was your, tell us about your field work, if you would.
Sure. Well, the field work was sponsored by the Social Science Research Council. And they had just, at that point, just after the ending of World War II, they had gone into the foreign studies field, which they hadn't done before. They'd been sticking pretty much to, I think, to the Western world anyway, if not the U.S. But they had started a foreign area fellowship program, and I was number one in line. So they gave me a year and a half of what was then a lot of money. $10,000 for a year and a half, and I found that would stretch a bit further too. I wrote a proposal, which was all about what was happening to caste in India with the changes of the new constitution, all the new ambitions. And, legislation that was going on, and how did this look at the village level? So I was going to, that was the program, basically. I was going to watch the, well, I didn't quite put it that way, but the falling apart of the caste system. totally misconceived, but anyhow, that was, that won the fellowship. So I, and when I, by then I had, a wife and 2 children, small ones, and we went off on a, we couldn't afford anything fancy, and there wasn't anything much, and we certainly couldn't go by air. That was extremely rare and very expensive in 1950. So we had to go by boat, and the only boat we could get was a freighter. So we got on a steel pipe carrying boat, which was going to deliver American pipe to some oil industries in the Mideast. We thought it was going to be Israel. It turned out not to be. But we went through Lebanon and Egypt and so on. Took a month, and headed for a place that had been recommended by Wisers, who were about 150, maybe 175 miles from Delhi, southeast of Delhi, where they'd been working for 30 years. And they said, well, why don't you work somewhere halfway from us to Delhi? And that would be an interesting area, maybe a bit more advanced in technology and so on. They were leaving. Then Wiser was suffering from terminal disease at the time, though he was still in another village. So I spent, I called on them and visited them also in Lucknow, the state capital. I started at the top. I had nice letters of introduction from the university here to whoever it may be in India, and that was a very good thing to do. And I went with the went to the chief people in Uttar Pradesh to get their blessings or approval. I met the leading social science people, especially the sociologists at Lucknow University, where they actually had somebody who called himself an anthropologist, and a couple of sociologists, one of whom was really a philosopher, and the other was a real sociologist, really, really interested in village work. And they interested me again, and so I got on to the district capital, turned out to be Aligarh district, and found that the Aligarh was in some turmoil because they had lots of, after the partition between India and Pakistan, they had a large number of refugees both ways. That is, that it had been the center of Muslim nobility. They'd been urged to cluster around the Aligarh Muslim University, which was patronized by the imperial government. But the Nawabs who built palaces there in Aligarh, many of them had left for Pakistan as soon as partition was declared, leaving their houses, and the windows were broken, and some of them were burned, and it was quite a mess. And on the other direction, there were lots of Hindus coming in from Pakistan territories into Aligarh. And they had their trains had been hijacked, and hundreds of passengers had been slaughtered, and so had those who were walking, and it was just, and there were people around who'd done the murders were still there, you know, they were the Hindu leaders, some of them, right-wing Hindus. And at that time, the tensions were such that the United Nations, UNESCO, I guess it wasn't, if they come into being then, I'm not sure, I don't remember the exact agency, but they'd set up a program to study under United Nations auspices social tensions in India, that is to try to reduce the troubles. It was to be headed up by Gardner Murphy, who was a social psychologist. And Murphy, I had met Murphy because I knew about the program going on, but he was about to start in India before I'd gone there, when I was getting ready to go to India. So, and he was very eager to have me there. I'd already, by then, I'd done some good deal of psychology here too at Chicago, Human Development Committee. It was especially welcoming. Lloyd Warner was in Human Development as well as in Anthropology and Sociology, or maybe he moved about that time. Anyways, he put me in touch with people like Bill Henry, who was a TAT man, and I studied Rorschach and so on. So Murphy thought, well, this is great to get somebody who knows something about these projective tests, and we're going to study the emotions behind the riots and all that. So he wanted to co-opt me into his team with investigators in Aligarh, and they were studying riots. Well, that was not a comfortable position to be in politically, because the collector, they'd had a riot just 6 months before I arrived there, and I, as an investigator from abroad, you know, as an American and a social scientist, would be something of a threat, because he had been responsible, he'd been held responsible for not sending in the police and to stop the riot, but he'd let some a Muslim athletic instructor get murdered by a mob. And so he was blamed for that, and naturally he worried about my investigation. It was a very touchy topic. So I had to steer clear. I refused to become a part of Murphy's team that was right there. But he had brought in a psychoanalyst who was himself a refugee from Pakistan, named Parsram. Parsram was a wonderful psychoanalyst. He just an absolutely charming man with enormous knowledge and very broad liberal views. He'd been trained in Murphy's own institute in the U.S., had been there before. And he was well acquainted with faculty here in University of Chicago. We hadn't met here, but I met him there, and he was next door neighbor. So it was very hard. And he was then the head of the local team. Well, I hung out with him a lot and learned a lot from him, but I couldn't join his team officially. But I helped his staff a little bit, you know, but I really didn't want to teach them. I didn't want to get deeply involved in it. My job was to get in from rural areas. So I had a Jeep. I brought one from the USA, actually, on that freighter. Began touring the rural areas. I had maps and census statistics and so on. I said I wanted to see what villages were like there. What was the range of types of villages and kinds of populations and so on, and occupations and everything else. I wanted a general survey of the district before I settled on any one spot. And I visited, I think, 75 villages and interviewed briefly for maybe an hour or two at least in each of them. And this was, again, rather upsetting to the local officials. The official had said, yes, you can come and so on. I encouraged friendly feelings by the collector, the head officer of the district, who was an Indian. Of course, he recently appointed to the position previously occupied by a British officer. He was having a wedding for his daughter. And we'd also arrived just a couple of months before the annual fair, county fair, you might say, of the district, where they had musical performances and things like that. And I had a tape recorder that I picked up in England. So I made recordings of what is called a mushaira, which is a poetic contest in poetry and song between dueling poets. And the idea of recording this was very attractive to the singers, naturally, to the poets. So they set me right up on the stage there with this thing, and I recorded these dialogues, which has helped my language learning. I had practically no language. Only language I'd learned ahead of coming was just from a set of phonograph records that had been made during the war and not used by anybody. But that put me up a bit anyway, and so I began to learn Urdu and Hindi and just Margaret Mead methods. That is, you know, you go and you imitate people and you make mistakes and they correct you, and pretty soon you're speaking the language. That's what I did. But this was a great, great help. In any case, I took these recordings, these musical things, which are greatly prized, and it was in a Muslim setting, though there were Hindus present, all kinds of poets were present. The language is really very similar. But then at this wedding, at the collector's wedding, he said, well, you were at the fair, at the Nimaish, and you have recordings of this mushaira, so why don't you bring it over? So I did, and that was a great hit. Well, the wedding party see. So I had some credits with the man, even though he was worried about me. His spies then were going around giving reports on my activities in the rural areas, which he was, you know, uncertain about. He said, he called me in, he said, is there a reason why I shouldn't throw you out of this district? I have reports that you've been inquiring about my administration. No, I hadn't been inquiring about his administration except to ask, you know, who is the head man of the village. You know, that was about it, you know. But that was dangerous information as far as he was concerned. Well, I somehow rather toughed that one out. But he said he's going to keep his eye on me. So anyway, settling the village was a bit of a problem because I was actually thrown out of three villages before I was able to settle where I wanted. I'd go into one place where I wanted a village that represented the whole range of, I wanted a fairly complex village where I had lots of different castes. I was supposed to study inter-caste relations and things like that. So I wanted a place that wasn't just one caste of people in the village, one or two, and there are a lot of villages like that where there are just farmers and one or two other cast in small villages of 500 or so. Well, I wanted a place small enough so that I could know everybody. That was the anthropological aim, of course, to do the whole community, which means you know everybody, more or less. And so it had to be pretty small, but it also had to be complex. So I found several places that were right. I certainly wanted Brahmins, and there were plenty of Brahmins around in that region. Not like South India, but north, northwestern part of Uttar Pradesh has lots of Brahmins there of all kinds, who are not necessarily priests at all, but farmers mostly. So any case, I found one village had a lot of Brahmins in it, and they even had a local temple, and I thought, well, that would be great too. It was important. It wasn't just a local temple, it was a regional temple that had people come by. They had an annual two or three festivals every year. And a community, a local community. But it seemed they said, oh yes, you come back, live. Everybody always says, yes, sure, yeah, whatever you want, yes. But I went back, and they said, well, we'll have a house for you. And I got there, and they showed me the pig pen. It was a place that had been occupied by a local pig herd, and he died, but his little mud hut, you know, yard for the pigs, that was it. I figured, well, that wasn't too welcoming, you know. And then I realized that after some study of reading the gazetteers and things like that, they looked like a fairly wealthy community, and they had this pretty fancy temple that clearly hadn't been built by the local Raja, the Raja who'd been there at the beginning of the 19th century, before the British takeover. He built this thing, and the reason why it was so well stocked with Brahmins and land grants and so on was because they were his funeral priests. And funeral priests take all the bad stuff along with the dead. So that's why, but they were quite isolated. They didn't, I inquired about their marriages and things like that. Nobody married them except their own little cluster of Brahmins because they were negatively toned as far as other Brahmins were concerned. So they were a little uncomfortable again about me learning too much about them. You know, I don't know what else they were involved in. So that was the pig pen story. Then I went to another village which looked like about the right kind of place again, which had lots of farmers in it and quite a few castes, there were three or four villages together that formed a sort of group, and I thought, well, that would be interesting too. You see the relation between the smaller and the larger villages. And I met a merchant. I also met an office boy in Aligarh who he had just had a wedding, his own daughter's wedding, And he had a spare house. He built a house for the bridegroom, who didn't stay there. He was just there for the wedding days. And he wanted to rent it. And that was in one of these little this cluster of villages. Well, I went there. So I had two or three contacts. I talked to one man who was quite fluent in English, a merchant of the oligarch lock industry. And he was very eager to meet me, and very friendly and comfortable with me, because he was an urban person. He lived in a village, but he was doing this urban. He was a traveling salesman for the lock industry, so he was fairly sophisticated, urbanite type. And he said, "Well, there's a village near here where he had a friend who was a vaid, a Muslim doctor, and he would probably be glad to have you living in his place." And he thought there were some empty spaces there that I could use. Went there, and they said, "Oh, yes, you can come here." Well, okay, so I spent another couple of days there. Around there, it seemed like a suitable place. But as I spent the night there and listened to the conversation, I had an interpreter working with me then, man from the city, from another city, and he said, "Well, they're bootleggers, and they're worried about you're bringing the police here, you know, and so they want to, you know, they weren't comfortable about it at all, so that didn't work out either." And then the merchant said, "Well, I've got another friend over here, and this other village," and that was the one that I really liked a whole lot when I first saw it, because it had an old mound, you know, it had obviously been there for hundreds and hundreds of years, and some of the villages up on top of the mound, and the very top was a fortress, a mud fortress, which had been used with a cannon on it, I think, in the early 19th century, and probably earlier too, because anyway. And it was much larger, and it had a lot of Brahmins. It had 24 castes represented in it. So that was perfect. And the friend turned out to be a giant landlord who lived in the castle up top. Not much of a castle, but fancier than anything else in the village. And he was very friendly, because he needed friends, for one thing. The majority of the people in the village, the control of the village, not the majority of people, one quarter of the population were Brahmin farmers. And they were subject to the Jats, who had taken over in the 17th century during the sort of crumbling of the Mughal authority. The Jats had moved in from across the Jamuna River into that area, and it had taken over, and they were pretty rough on the local Brahmins, who were otherwise, they had a Rajput king before, and the Rajput had been driven out, and then the Jats took over. In any case, the Jats, as rulers now, were demanding that the Brahmins give them a lot of deference. They had to stand up whenever the landlord walked by and do all kinds of things that were sort of very irritating to the Brahmins, who thought they were the top people. But this landlord then, who was remaining job landlord, there were a few others, two or three others, but he was the only one who really had any land still under his own control. But he was eager to have me, and he had a little English, and he had a son in high school, and thought, well, that would be a good thing to have, and then he found this city office boy who had the house to rent. That was in the Potter's Quarter, actually. My neighbors were Cotton Carter, a group of potters, and a couple of Muslim families. That was the neighborhood in the village.
And the idea was that by having a village that had all of it, that was richly represented by caste, you could study the dynamics.
Right. I could study, and it turned out to be just wonderful for that purpose, because, I moved in and to this house, people were very suspicious of me, of course. I wonder what the world is going to bring me there. But I have a nice greeting because I told them I was going to come, and then I got loaded up my Jeep and came down there. I was alone. I installed my wife and children in a house in Eligar City, which had a decent well, and so on. The village didn't have anything like that. The well was just a hole in the ground. It wasn't even improved, just a hole in the dirt, you know. And that didn't look like a safe situation for a couple of toddlers. So, any case, whatever it is, I moved into this house, and I found waiting for me 8 servants in a little one-room house for me and my translator. They said they all belonged to the house. They were part, and so I was immediately immersed in this, and I was their master. So there was the carpenter who could repair the door, or the people who would plaster the place with cow dung plaster to refreshen it every now and then, you know, when it got too dry and dusty. There was the water carrier, and there was somebody to haul away the trash, and there was the barber who went with it and used to cut my hair and wash my dishes. And you
were expected to be their employer.
I was their employer. Wonderful. Here I am, the guest. You know.